One thing that you can tell from this set of data is what? It's that not everyone is right. Can't possibly be all be right because you're contradicting each other. And that could be for a lot of reasons. A lot of things you could do. For instance, write down incorrectly which one's 1, 2, and 3 when you do it. That would make a big difference. But chances are you did that correctly, and then there's other reasons why you're coming up with different answers. And that's the whole point of doing this first round, which is kind of the dirty round, so that we can talk about how you can actually improve the experiment a lot more. First, though, how did you actually determine, make your determination? There's not one way you could do this. What did you do? So you had an initial and a final mass? Okay. And that's the best way of doing this. That's the whole idea, is that the relationship between the potato and the liquids is that there might be some gain or loss of water, right, via osmosis. So that's the right way of going about it. But even though did you all do that? I mean, did anyone do something different? You all did the same thing but came up with different answers. So first let me just talk briefly about osmosis. Before I even get to osmosis specifically, let me say that there are... The reason we're studying it is because it's an important means by which particles can be taken into a cell or taken out of a cell. There are three major categories, though, of doing so. Three major processes by which materials can either exit or enter a cell. Who wants to guess at what those three major categories are? What types of processes? Categories of processes. Diffusion is an example of one of the categories. So, diffusion is an example of what kind of transport? Passive transport is one of them. Active transport is another. What's the third category? Active transport and passive transport are different, of course, because of energy, right? Passive transport does not require additional energy. There's already energy built into the system that will allow it to happen, whereas active requires additional energy. But they have something in common. They both move particles through a membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. The third category can get things into or out of the cell, but kind of as a cheating mechanism, because nothing actually ever goes through a membrane in this case. What am I talking about? How do cells do that? Endocytosis is an example. The category itself is called vesicular transport. Transport via vesicles, in other words. And so endocytosis and exocytosis, pinocytosis, phagocytosis, those are all examples of vesicular transport, the third category. Okay, so we're not, in this actual example, talking about two of these categories. Which are the two that we're not talking about here? Happening with your potatoes. Active transport and vesicular transport. Right? We're talking about passive transport. That's what osmosis is an example of. The most frequently observed example, though, of passive transport is diffusion. In fact, passive transport is diffusion, but sometimes we give special cases of it a special name. Osmosis is just a special case of diffusion. Osmosis is diffusion, but not all of diffusion is osmosis. Okay, it's a subset of diffusion. So let's just say quickly what diffusion is. I said it's passive, which means it has energy built into the system. What is the form of that energy that causes diffusion to occur? What actually forces diffusion to happen? What is it?
Gradient.
Right. A gradient. A gradient is a form of potential energy and can do some work for you. You'll talk more about that when you talk about cellular respiration. But anyway, there's all kinds of gradients. Gradient, just the word by itself, is a general term that refers to some difference that you can measure. And so there's all kinds of gradients depending on what the difference is in. For instance, pressure gradients. You know, that's why water comes out of the faucet, because there's higher pressure inside, lower pressure outside. Voltages are gradients. A voltage is really just a gradient of electrical potential energy. So there's a charge gradient, charge difference from one electrode to the other. But when it comes to diffusion, what gradients are we talking about? What kind of gradients? Concentration gradients, yeah. Which means there is a difference in concentration of some sort of particle at one place compared to another place. All right? Now, diffusion, seemingly paradoxically, diffusion is a directed process. It has a direction to it, even though it's caused by random movement of particles. So when I say it's a directed process, I mean that it's always occurs, the net diffusion always occurs in one direction, from high concentration of that particle to low concentration. Okay, so it's always down the gradient. But even though it's moving in one direction, always down the gradient, that movement is because of just random motion of particles. And even though it seems paradoxical, it really isn't. Let me give you an example that kind of explains why that can be true. If you model solutes in a solution, and I suppose we should quickly define those terms. A solution is a mixture, right? A certain type of mixture. A mixture in which you have two sorts of particles, solvent particles and solute particles. The solute particles are the things being dissolved. The solvent is doing the dissolving, and the combination of the two is the solution. Okay. If you model a solution with people who volunteer to be in the model, and each person represents a solute particle, if you conduct this in a big room like a gymnasium, you know, you could have 100 people representing individual molecules of some solvent, or some solute, whatever it is. This represents, for instance, a real-world example of if you put a sugar cube into a beaker of water, for instance, right? But each person represents a sugar molecule. When you get down to looking at individual molecules, they're all moving, even in a solid. They're all vibrating, right? Each individual particle is moving at some speed, depends on the individual particle, and in some direction. So in the model, when people are representing the molecules, you can freeze time for the moment while you set them up. First of all, you lump them all together in the center of the room because they're a sugar cube to begin with. They're still with each other. But you position each person facing some random direction, representing the direction that they're going to move as particles once I start the clock, right? And if a particle hits another particle, it bounces off in the appropriate direction and goes in a straight line until it hits something else. That's how real particles operate. So if I get them all situated and say, okay, start, if you imagine the people in the middle of that group, it doesn't matter which direction they're facing. They're going to just run into another person right away. They're just going to keep bouncing off of each other, right? Now consider the group of people that are on the periphery, the edge of the group. Could be that just randomly a person on the edge is facing inward, so they're just going to run into a person right away as well. But some of them randomly will be going in a direction that moves them away from the group. And they'll be able to move a much longer distance until they hit a wall and start bouncing around, right? The more people move away from that group, the more people still in that group are then going to be able to do the same thing and leave if they happen to be going in the right direction. So if you let the clock run after a while, the random motion will be such that there is no longer a group of people concentrated. They will have dispersed. That's the way diffusion works, even though it's random movement. Okay? So it's a directed process caused by a random motion. Now, that's really all you need. Well, there are two things that you need for diffusion to occur. For net diffusion to occur, which means movement in one direction more than another. Those two requirements are that there has to be a concentration gradient. If there is no gradient, or if the gradient is zero, we just say there's no gradient, then there's going to be no tendency to move from point A to point B greater than there is a tendency to move from point B to point A, right? So you have to have a gradient if diffusion is going to occur. Plus, there has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. If it's blocked by something, the gradient itself will make it want to move from A to B in a sense, but if it's not able to, of course it's not going to. Now in the sugar example, there's nothing stopping sugar molecules from leaving that clump and going out into the water. And by the way, at the same time, water is diffusing down its own gradient, right? When you first put the sugar in there, where the sugar is high concentration of sugar, low concentration of water. Where it's watery surroundings, that's high concentration of water, low concentration of sugar. Two different particles, each with its own gradient. And when things diffuse, they diffuse only because of their own gradient. It doesn't matter what other things are happening, what other types of particles are present. So the sugar leaves where it's sugary and goes to where it's watery. And the water leaves from where it's watery and goes to where it's sugary. Because each one is going down its gradient. It's going, moving from where there's more of it to where there's less of it. All right, that's just diffusion. The reason I mentioned the second requirement, that there needs to be a way for something to get from A to B, down its gradient, is that sometimes a thing that's impeding that movement is a membrane. And this is one of the reasons why osmosis is a special case of diffusion. In the beaker example, the movement of water toward the sugar cube is not osmosis. That's just diffusion of water. Okay? In the potato example, or in any time you have a cell surrounded by some solution, that cell, of course, has a membrane. And if something goes into or out of a cell through the membrane, then you have the possibility of it being osmosis. So here's the reason osmosis is a special case of diffusion. For one thing, usually when we talk about diffusion, we're talking about diffusion of solute particles. Not always, but usually. Osmosis is not diffusion of solute particles. Osmosis is diffusion of solvent particles. Now, most books will say that it's diffusion of water. And in biology, that's okay to say that because whenever we're talking about a biological solution, the solvent is water, right? It's aqueous solutions that biochemistry takes place in. But strictly speaking, osmosis could be any solvent moving. It's just that in biology, that's always water. But that doesn't go far enough. It's not simply the diffusion of water, because that's what was happening in the sugar cube example, and I just told you that's not osmosis. Osmosis instead is the diffusion of solvent particles through a membrane, through a selectively permeable membrane. Okay? And therefore, the potato example, you do have osmosis occurring, but not in the beaker example, the sugar cube in the beaker example. All right, now, I said earlier that any given kind of particle has its own gradient, and that's really the only thing that determines whether it's going to move by a diffusion. That's true for water in the case of osmosis. And so the types of solutes that are inside the cell and outside the cell do not determine whether water moves into the cell or not. The types of solutes do not. It only matters what the overall concentration of solutes is. And in a sense, that doesn't even really matter I mean, what I'm saying is that water moves simply because of its own gradient. But the water concentration is really just the determined by the solute concentration, right? This is why a lot of textbooks, in my opinion, have phrased the definition of osmosis in a way that seems confusing. Because diffusion is simple enough. It's always movement of a particle from high concentration to low concentration, right? And then a lot of books will define osmosis as movement of water from an area of low solute concentration to high solute concentration. And that is true, but it by saying it moves from low to high makes it seem like it's different from diffusion. But notice it's not low water to high water concentration, it's low solute to high solute concentration. And when you say something has a low solute concentration, that's just really a backwards way of saying that it has a high water concentration, right? If there aren't many solutes present, that means it's almost all solvent, in this case water. So I think I just prefer to phrase it the more direct way and say that osmosis is movement of water down its own gradient from a place where there's high water concentration to where there's low water concentration through a membrane. Now the reason the membrane makes the difference here is because it's a selectively permeable membrane. Water is able to permeate the membrane, go through it, but the solutes are not. All right? So normally, if you had a membrane between two different solutions, that differ in their concentrations, you would have movement of water and solutes, both, each down its own gradient. That's not what happens in osmosis, though, because the solutes are either locked into the cell or locked out of the cell. And water is the only thing that can move. And this is why it doesn't matter what kind of solutes you have. The inside of the cell is a complex mixture of solutes. There's all kinds of different solutes. But you can add them all up and divide by the volume and you can get an overall concentration of solutes, right? That can be a totally different group of solutes, and in fact is a totally different group of solutes compared to the extracellular fluid. But if they're both at the same concentration, even though they're different types of solutes, then that's just another way of saying that they're equally watery, right? And that wateriness is the only thing that matters for osmosis. Water is only always going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery by osmosis. Okay, so we have to then quickly define the three levels of tonicity. What are the three words I'm talking about? What are the levels of tonicity? Hypertonic, hypotonic, isotonic. All right? Importantly, and I hear people using this, even people who should know better, misusing these words. These words should never be used to describe a cell. These words are used to describe the surroundings that a cell is in. In other words, the solution that is bathing the cell, not the cell itself. All right? Also, these words don't mean anything absolutely. So it doesn't make sense to say that a solution is hypertonic, isotonic, or hypotonic unless there's a cell in it, a specific cell you use as a reference point. Okay? But there's these three levels, three categories of tonicity. So a solution that has some cells in it is going to be classified as being one and exactly one of those three categories: hypertonic, isotonic, or hypotonic. There's another source of confusion here linguistically. Hypo means below, right? Hyper means above. But these prefixes are used to describe the level of the solute, even though water is the thing that's actually moving in osmosis. So, for instance, hypotonic refers to a solution that has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. That's why hypo is used. Okay? But this is a backwards way of thinking about it in terms of osmosis, because it's really the wateriness that matters, right? Hypotonic is low solute concentration compared to the cell, but that's just means it's more watery than the cell. And that's why a hypotonic solution is one that's going to cause influx or inward movement of water to the cell. It's backwards because you should really be calling it, you should be using prefixes that describe the wateriness, since that's really what matters. Yeah, but it's not. It's backwards. And so it refers to the solutes, but the solutes don't move. They stay either outside or inside the cell. The opposite of that is hypertonic. Hyper means high level, above. Well, that's a high level of solutes, but that means it's not watery. It's not very watery at all. So a hypertonic solution is one that is going to cause cells to lose water by osmosis because the cell will be more watery than the exterior solution. Okay? And iso means same. So that simply means it's the same wateriness. Doesn't matter whether it's totally different solutes inside and out. If they add up to the same concentration, then that means same wateriness inside and out. And water will go in and out at the same rate, and you won't gain or lose any mass. Okay, so in terms of this experiment, it's you set it up properly. You thought about the correct way of doing this. You need to measure not the mass of the potato, but the change in mass of the potato, right? Which is why you need an initial and a final mass. And from the discussion we just had about osmosis, hopefully it makes sense to you that you should have negative values and positive values, depending on what the solution is, right? Which kind of solution should give you a negative change in mass? A hypertonic solution, exactly. A hypotonic solution should give you a positive change in mass because the cells will take in water. And if it just happens to be isotonic, and I'm not saying any of these is isotonic, but if it were isotonic, it would be isotonic because it would give no change in mass for the cells. All right? So how can we improve this experiment drastically? Well, mostly by controlling variables very well. Remember we talked about controlled variables last time? So what are the important variables to control here? How are we going to standardize things? What about the potato? First of all, it's the same species. That's already taken care of. Okay, the size. And what do you mean by size? Do you mean the actual dimensions of it or the mass? Okay, it should always be the same. And by the way, on this second round, because you're going to do the same thing again, but better, even though you're working as individual groups, you're going to pool all your data. And therefore, you not only have to be standardized within your own experiment, the whole class has to be standardized now. So, we need to come up with a mass to start with. What's the right mass to use? I don't know what masses you were using before, but you should use, let's say, 5 grams of potato. Well, five is enough for good results. So make it 5 grams of potato in each beaker. Okay, but also in each group. But it's not just the mass that matters. What else can matter? The amount of solution can matter, right? So that should be standardized at, I don't know, what do you think is appropriate? What's the correct amount of each solution to use? I mean, what do you want to use? 100 milliliters? 100 milliliters. Make that a standard. But what else about the potato, besides the mass of it, matters? Yeah.
The shape?
Exactly. The shape can matter. Why does the shape matter? If you have two pieces that are the same mass, why would the shape matter? Exactly. Surface area is really what's mattering here. And shape, different shapes have different surface area to volume ratios. Now, if you think about water osmosing, it's doing so at the interface between cell and environment, right? So you know, this is like people trying to get into a stadium. They have to go through turnstiles. The more turnstiles you have, the faster a crowd can get into the stadium. The gradient is trying to force them in, but like I said, you have to have a way to get in there. Well, the way to get in there is to have contact between water and cells, and therefore surface area is a variable that you want to control. So you make them all the same shape as well. And that's why we have core sampling tools here for you. The best way of standardizing, I mean, you could make them any shape that you determine, but it'll be difficult using the tools you have available to make them all perfect rectangular boxes or whatever. Use the core sampling tool, and then all you have to do is make them an exact length and make the cuts at right angles at the ends of those cylinders. You also don't want to have any skin on it, right? That might affect how much osmosis occurs. So make it just the white of the potato. So use the larger of the two as your standard diameter. All right? And then use, let's say, well, I just gave you a standard mass. Actually, let's just go with a standard length of this size. So let's say 3 centimeters. 3 centimeters. Okay? Which all should weigh about the same. And you're going to weigh them anyway, but make that your standard shape and size. Okay, so you have what other kinds of variables here that you can control? Yeah. Time that they're soaking, right? Yeah, that's going to be important. What else can you control? Oh, by the way, we need to standardize that as well. So let's make it 20 minutes of soaking. No matter when you start, pay attention to when you start. Take them out after 20 minutes exactly. And we should be using the same temperature water, right? Control temperature. What did I want to say? There was something. I don't remember right now. Oh, well. You are going to be using basically the same temperature if you use... They're all sitting out at the same room. So you're not... I mean, unless you intentionally use hot water or something, which I'm telling you not to do for this part of the experiment. Okay, so those are the big things to standardize. And you'll be getting a... Oh, now I remember what I was going to say. When your actual direct measurements today are all masses, right? That's what you're actually measuring. But you compute then a change in mass. So when you graph this thing, you wouldn't graph the final mass. You would graph the change in mass, right? Which is why it could be either positive zero or negative, depending on the nature of the solution. That would be on the y-axis, of course. What is your independent variable that would be on the x-axis? What are you adjusting? The type of solution, right? Which you don't know the identity of, but it's one unknown 1, 2, and 3. And therefore, since you don't know what each one is until after you get your data and can make a guess as to that, what would be the appropriate kind of graph to use? Yeah, it's a categoric independent variable, right? They don't relate to each other numerically. So it'd be like red, green, and yellow. So it'd just be a bar graph, right? But anyway, those are important things that you need to keep in mind. There's actually 3 phases to this. This is the second phase, and do this carefully. We're not going to put it on the board because that was just a category guess, least, most, or medium. For this next one, though, you want to have a careful measurement of change in mass. And you should all have basically the same starting mass because you're making them standardized shape and size. But anyway, write down the beginning and ending mass so that you can calculate that change in mass. And then walk around to the other groups and get their data as well so that you can just process all the numbers as one big pool of data. So you get an average for 1, 2, and 3. Okay? Now the third phase, technically we're supposed to wait until we end the second phase to do the third one, but I'm just going to have you do it at the same time. Or as soon as you get your experiment up and running, think about this other one. And the other one is really just kind of a contest. The main experiment is the second phase, but that's really what you'll be writing about in the mini report. The third one, though, is a challenge. If we standardize if we give you as a mass 5 grams, you have to stay at 5 grams. It has to be a 5 gram piece of potato. This is an independent one, so that's why you have 4 beakers, for instance, in case you need a beaker for the final experiment. But given a 5 gram piece, and it's just one piece, 5 grams, try to see whether you can gain the most mass in that piece, however you want to make that piece, whatever materials you want to use at your disposal. The things that are sitting out at the table, anything sitting up here, is you can use. But see whether you can cause your piece of potato to gain more mass than any of the other groups. Okay? All right, that's it.